Donald Iacovone joins us this morning to discuss the paperback release of his latest book, Teaching White Supremacy, America's Democratic Ordeal and the Forging of Our National Identity. The book shows us the clear and damning evidence of white supremacy's deep-seated roots in our nation's educational system through in-depth examination of America's wide assortment of texts, from primary readers to college textbooks, from popular histories to the most influential academic scholarship. Sifting through a wealth of materials from the colonial era to today, Iacovone reveals the systemic ways in which this ideology has infiltrated all aspects of American culture and how it has been at the heart of our collective national identity. Donald Iacovone is a lifetime associate at Harvard University's Hutchins Center for African and African American Research, the author or editor of 9 books, and a recipient of the W.E.B. Du Bois Medal from Harvard University in 2013. Again, the paperback release is Teaching White Supremacy, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Donald Iacovone back to the roundtable. Thank you so much for being with us. What a delight to have you here.
Well, thank you for the invitation. I really appreciate it.
We had you on when the book first came out, and now the paperback has come out. And I mean, not that you ever thought that it wouldn't be, but the book, we need it more now than ever, right? I mean, it's just the last year has proven just how necessary this volume is.
Well, thanks. And when I finished it, I thought, my God, we can't understand the current social crisis without the information that's here. Now, I didn't start this book until way before Donald Trump was elected president. In fact, I was in the middle of another project, and I was diverted, overwhelmed by this collection of textbooks at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. But what these things revealed to me, and all the other research that I did, was the centrality, the utter centrality of the definition of the true American as white. Now, I didn't start with that assumption. It was proven to me after going through the collection of 3,000 history textbooks in the library.
Right.
And the message that came through loud and clear, as obvious and as poignant, if that's the right word, as unmistakable, was statements directly from these books about the centrality of whiteness to American culture. This was America. And anything else that wasn't of European descent was either a threat or was somehow, quote, a problem, unquote.
You write in the epilogue of the book, the Confederate flag swayed during the January 6th, 2021 assault on the U.S. Capitol and on American democracy. Such emblems sometimes can be diverting symbols, tempting viewers to shrug off racial oppression as something as extinct as the Confederacy and Southern slavery. In this case, far from it. I'm interested in looking a little bit into that idea of what gave us an idea that we could shrug off that oppression and shrug off those symbols.
Well, yes, thanks for focusing on that. And I think it's really relevant to understand our current social crisis. The reason why I wrote it and in that way was because most Americans conceive of racism, and I think most Americans recognize the existence of racism, and especially those who are sympathetic to the long and difficult history that African Americans have endured, and along with those who are, let us say, less interested, all of them collectively tend to believe that this issue, this problem, is the result of Southern slavery. That explains everything. Well, unfortunately, it doesn't. And what I tried to show, particularly in the first two chapters of the book, was the centrality of racial issues to Northerners and how important, how critical, how indispensable Northerners were to the creation of white supremacy. This was not a Southern creation. This was a national creation, and all sections bear responsibility for what happened.
You write in those first two chapters and focus on what you just mentioned, but also showing that Northern leaders had this hand in the construction of the color line. Talk to us a little bit about that and why that is so poignant.
Well, let me give you an example. There is, I think, many people might have at some point heard of Samuel Sewall.
Yes.
And he was mostly remembered, or is mostly remembered, as being the judge in the Salem witchcraft trials. Well, he was also the author of the first anti-slavery pamphlet in American history. It came out in 1700, The Selling of Joseph. And here is an example of a Northerner who decried the institution of slavery, who denounced the seizure of Africans and shipping them across the Atlantic to the New World, decried it as ungodly, as anti-Christian. Yet, when he wrote his pamphlet, and also in his diary, extensive diary, he recognized that most of the people he knew, most of his fellow white settlers, European, people of European descent, could not accept the idea of a free person of African descent. It was inconceivable to them. And even in his case, even as an abolitionist, as a firm and dedicated abolitionist, the presence of people of African descent unnerved him. It made him wonder, and these are his own words from his diary, made him wonder if he would keep his whiteness, quote, after the resurrection, unquote.
Mm.
I chose him because he's a Northerner, of course.
Right.
He's a New Englander. He's an abolitionist. And this issue of race, we have to remember that race and slavery, are, in a way, are two different issues. And they have, you can be a dedicated abolitionist, even a New Englander in the 19th century, before the Civil War, a dedicated abolitionist, and still not accept people of African descent as their equals. This is something that is burned into American culture from the outset, 100 years before the settlement of the English colonies. Slavery, the slave trade existed. So they had 100 years to associate people of African descent with slaves, even though prior to that there were Africans in Europe, there were Africans in Spain and Portugal and England. Black ambassadors went to the Vatican, yet all this was wiped away by the notion that people of African descent were, for Europeans' sake, slaves and nothing, and could be nothing else. And there was a threat if they were free, a threat to the settlers and then to free Americans afterwards. It's so profoundly burned into American consciousness. And, you know, this collection that I looked at of textbooks revealed that and was propounded generation after generation after generation, and actually became more intense at the beginning of the 20th century and continued for most of the 20th century.
You write in that part when you're mentioning Samuel Sewall that you were just talking about, that Edward Channing had this 6-volume history of the U.S. Mm-hmm. that won the Pulitzer Prize. And there was one part of that that I flagged, because you write his text reflected the then common perception that most slaves did not suffer extraordinary abuse.
Right.
And that struck me because we hear that today.
We certainly do.
Hear that in the textbooks that are being written and being introduced in Florida, Texas, and beyond.
Yes. Yeah. The governor of Florida recently declared that slavery was an advantage to people of African descent because they were able to learn trades, quote unquote. Well, this is a notion that became, this idea of this interpretation of slavery became extremely popular in the 20th century. I would not be the least bit surprised if people like Governor DeSantis read such things when they were children. In fact, there were historians, some of the nation's leading historians of the 20th century, described slavery as a philanthropic institution that brought people out of Africa, which was some dark, you know, and despicable place, and gave them a future here in the United States. Now, it is certainly true that people who were enslaved learned all kinds of businesses and trades. And indeed, they created the wealth, much of the wealth the nation is founded on. And certainly, the South was founded on. There were carpenters, there were, tradesmen of all sorts, but this was anything but an advantage. They were bound, and their lives were completely determined by their owners, and their families were separated. I doubt that there was any family of African descent who was enslaved that didn't suffer some loss. Absolutely. Yet, to assuage consciousness, I don't know. People of European descent, like DeSantis, want to soften the past, and presumably some sense of guilt that they're afraid of. It's quite puzzling, but it is part of a nationwide trend for many, many Americans, who are white or of European descent, to escape this sense of guilt, which I don't know why they would feel guilty. They didn't own slaves, but for some reason they feel that it's an onus on them. And that, in another way, perhaps eases or eliminates the possibility and responsibility to treat people of African descent equally and to make up for the oppression that they suffered for so many years. Why should there be a civil rights movement when they enjoyed such an easy life in slavery? Right? Yeah. And it's revolting, frankly.
Donald Iacovone is the author of Teaching White Supremacy. The book is published by Vintage. You write in the book, for parents or school administrators who object to any emphasis on African Americans and the role of race in American history, modern technology offers an escape. Talk a little bit about that and why that is not a golden answer to this issue, of course.
I think we at this point recognize the many faces of the World Wide Web. It offers many countless opportunities. For instance, much of the work that I've been doing for the last 10 years would be impossible without digitized newspapers. It's utterly impossible. On the other hand, it allows individuals who refuse to accept modern scholarship in public education to go back even to the 19th century and use textbooks and other sources to utterly and completely escape current scholarship. So many homeschoolers, for instance, rely on the World Wide Web and can and do, in fact, not use modern textbooks, but in fact use 19th century ones or 20th century ones, which we've just been talking about with those same attitudes. So it truly is a double-edged sword, and it just helps in the persistence of these issues like Governor DeSantis raises nationally.
The subtitle to your book is America's Democratic Ordeal and the Forging of Our National Identity, which leads me to probably the most difficult question that we all should be asking, but that I'll ask you is, so how do we correct that? How do we change the national identity? And because we are not just changing the record, we're changing ourselves.
Yeah, this is a question that has come up again and again in almost all the events that I've spoken at, both online and in person. And it clearly is the burning question. Unfortunately, there isn't a simple answer for this. However, one way is to focus on something which all students used to recite every morning. I think that probably many still do. Pledge of Allegiance, which ends with liberty and justice for all. If that becomes the defining issue for Americans, if the promise of democracy becomes the aim and goal and underlying principle of all Americans, these issues will disappear. The ones that we're dealing with today, this social crisis today. If we focus on the promise of democracy, I think that's the underlying principle which we need to adopt to fight these injustices which are resurfacing again and again and again.
Do we want to?
Of us don't.
Yeah.
Many of us do not, because their world, their identities, their personal identities, their national identities, and their world is all a white one. They have one of the things that I have noticed both in the historical record and in contemporary life is the degree to which many Americans of European descent have little or no contact with people outside of that world, of that background. This was very true in the 19th century. Northerners would see people of African descent at a distance but have no contact with them. They knew nothing about them. All they knew was the rumors and, crippled ideas that got disseminated. They didn't know or spend time with people of African descent. And to many, many Americans today, that's still the case. In fact, in some ways, it's stronger in the North than in the South. Now, I lived for 6 years in Tallahassee, Florida. That's panhandle culture. That's deep South.
Right.
And I rarely heard any disparaging comments there about people of African descent. But when I moved to Boston, it was everywhere.
But obviously, it's more than geography. And it's very much ingrained in who we are, in conscious and unconscious. And it would seem to me then we each are responsible for taking stock of our knowledge and our part of the national identity.
Yeah, we have an obligation. We have to put ourselves in other people's shoes. Now, when I grew up, to be Italian and Polish was not an advantage. In fact, I heard so many dumb Polack jokes growing up that when somebody asked me what my background was, this is when I was a kid, I avoided saying Polish because it was only going to incite the person to come up with yet another dumb Polack joke. It was an embarrassment to be who I was. I learned kind of early what it's like to be in someone else's shoes.
There's a difference, obviously, between hope and optimism, but where does your optimism lie?
As a older person now, I've had the opportunity to experience a lot that I wouldn't have as a, say, a graduate of college. And one thing that is profoundly different, and as an older person, I can testify to this, television. When I was young, there were no black people on TV. And then if there were, they were servants, fools, that sort of thing. Black people didn't sell products. They were largely absent. It was a profoundly white world. That's not the case anymore. And in fact, The music industry, for instance, these days seems to be almost wholly dominated by people of African descent. So the exposure that even isolated people of European descent, their exposure to people who are not white is greater than it had ever been before. I am, however, worried because whiteness is a flexible idea. And early on, when the second chapter of the book is about the father of American racism, John H. Van Every, and he included people who were Jewish in his definition of whiteness. Now, by the time he died in 1896, that wasn't the case. So whiteness is a fluid notion. It can include people. It can exclude people. People who were Irish were not considered white. In fact, the English, people of English descent, referred to people who were Irish as a separate race, quote-unquote. And they used that term. They were a completely separate race. That was taken care of in the United States during the mid-19th century as Irish proved their quote-unquote whiteness to their fellow Americans by attacking people of African descent. And they were hired in jobs that prior to their immigration that people of African descent had filled. So they became gradually white. And this is happening today. People have complained, and you know, the border wall with Mexico, complaining terribly about this quote unquote invasion of brown people from Central and South America. But it doesn't include Cubans. They seem to welcome Cubans. So there are avenues in which people who can gain whiteness. So it's a flexible notion. And that makes elimination of this problem all the more difficult. Plus, and this is a really difficult one, the whole idea of races is a fiction created in the 18th century and only developed in the 19th century, which continues today. Races, there's no such thing as a race. It's a an invention to categorize people who come from different geographic locations, and it's a way to enforce the idea that people of European descent are at the top of this pyramid and people of African descent are at the bottom. There's no question about it. There's no genetic justification for this idea of race. So racists don't exist, but racism certainly does, because we believe that races exist. So we are trapped in this cage of language, which adopts the language of racism even as we try to eliminate it. So the challenges we face are really baked into the very language we use to describe the problem. But I have, in my lifetime, seen tremendous changes. And so I am optimistic that in time these issues will diminish, but it won't diminish without an understanding of the history of this problem.
Well, it's an amazing history that you have written. The name of the book is Teaching White Supremacy, America's Democratic Ordeal and the Forging of Our National Identity. Donald Iacovone, I thank you so much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you so much, and I hope this helps.
Be well. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Again, the name of the book is Teaching White Supremacy. It is published in paperback by Vintage. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.